if you can, just even if we have your email, just take a moment. I hope you enjoyed reading this book. I don't know for whom this was new, if you had already read this before. I want to thank Adina and David, of course, but really Adina for hosting tonight, but also for kind of spearheading this idea. We did it. We had a book discussion or two last summer, and she had been, as a member of the Women's Council, had been talking about it for a while and organizing and thinking. So just by a show of hands, how many people read the book? Okay, strong majority here. How many people found it enjoyable? How many people found it humorous? How many people found it depressing? Depressing, okay. So one of the amazing things about reading books is that you can have a lot of different perspectives on the same book. I found this book to be really thought-provoking. I thought it was also hilarious. And it was interesting because when I first discussed this book with someone, when I presented it to them, they said to me, "You're going to talk about a book that's all about suicide?" And my first reaction was, I didn't know that the book had anything to do with suicide. I didn't even notice that suicide was even a topic. That totally kind of blew right by me, because I didn't see that as the main point of the book at all. So I think the way one can look at this book is almost like a Musar Sefer. There are certain things that we should not do, and then there are certain things that we should do. So I think there's a lot, there's so much rich content in terms of thinking about how we lead our lives, which I thought was really interesting. I also thought this is the first book that I've ever read from Frederick Backman, and I have not had a chance to read much since I read this book the last vacation, and I haven't read any of the other ones since. I suspect maybe some of you have read Berit Marie or any of the other. Anybody else read any of the other Frederick Backman?
Beartown,
you read? So I don't know if the style is similar to this one. Structurally different. But one of the interesting things that I thought was a good take home about this book, before we talk about the content, is the style in which it's written and how Backman uses a very powerful literary tool, which is really useful in the context of teaching, especially when it comes to teaching Torah. And that is the power of the mashal, of the parable, the simile, the metaphor. It's something that comes up over and over in the book, and it's something that we can use in our life, especially when we are educators and we are facilitating conversations. All good? Good? The idea of a metaphor and how you convey something that I learned to appreciate when I was in yeshiva, when I was in Kerem Yavne, my Rebbe, Rav Moshe Stav, he used to use mashalim all the time. And the idea of a mashal is that it gives you an image in your mind. It gives you a very particular image, and it paints the picture in a very strong way. So you can flip through this book, and you will come up with so many powerful images that can't really be conveyed in the original language. For example, he uses this line. I love this line. The child looks at him as if he had just offered her a beer and a cigarette. Right? You could have said the child looked at him confused. But when you give that amount of detail, you really convey the feeling. There are so many. When Ove picks up the bottle, the cat looks at him in horror, as if to shout, "J'accuse," which is a reference to Emile Zola and the Dreyfus Affair. V'chahena, v'chahena, so many and so many. So the idea that when you tell a story, you utilize metaphors that people can draw on to appreciate something, it gives it so much more texture, so much more depth. So I think that was one kind of general style that you'll notice in this volume, which we can apply in our own lives in different ways. Another interesting phenomenon, just structurally, about this book is how it develops. You know, this is something that when in the Kollel, when we think about how to teach something, how to structure a presentation. So one of the questions that we ask ourselves is, why should somebody keep listening? You know, if I'm going to give a drasha, so first of all, you have to be mindful of the time. There is a woman in our neighborhood. Her name is Lydia Carroll. She gives the best advice about drasha giving, which I've given to the fellows many times. You can imagine. Lydia Carroll says, a good drasha is like a carjacking. You get in, you get what you need, and you get out. So that's one piece of advice, which is good. But the other way of thinking about this is, what's going to keep people interested? And that is sometimes a measure of suspense. And you notice how, as the book unfolds, you become more aware of the situation. So for those who haven't read the book, there are going to be some spoilers right here. You don't realize that Ove had a wife who had a disability. And you didn't realize that he was going to the grave of this late wife to talk to her. That he was planting flowers. And so many things only become clear. So the picture only becomes full as you go through it. So it becomes more and more interesting because the picture becomes more and more clear. So when we think about how we present things structurally, that's a really interesting tool, because now, as it's like an onion, as you're unpeeling one layer, you find another one and another one and another one. So those are just two structural observations. Anybody have any, you know, we talked about the format for this, so I don't know if we settled on anything, but I guess we should put it out just for initial observations in terms of the content. So what did people think were the themes, or some themes, or a theme that come up in this book? What was the theme that jumped out before we get to my observation about the Moshe Sefer? Yes.
The last point that you just made about how you discover things as you're reading, or your earlier presumptions are challenged when you find out more information. For me, it was all about, like, you don't really know a person until you really get to know them, and, you know, don't judge people.
Okay, not judging people. And you notice that plays its way out, you could say, in the book in different ways, even just in terms of some of the characters. As you find out a little bit more about them, you know, what made them tick, or what was their history, and, you know, what set off this particular interaction. Yeah, you never know. That's what else?
I also thought the power of a community, that you see this one block of people, and at first it appears as though they may not get along, and then you see how integrated they are into one another's lives and how that becomes so powerful.
And literally, it becomes integrated into Ove's life. I don't know if that's how you're supposed to pronounce it, because I don't drive a Saab, but let's call it Ove for a moment. It's clearly that's Hatzalah's nefashas, that literally gives him life. It's the community that keeps him alive.
Right.
And it's funny how, he, from his vantage point, you know, his curmudgeon-y attitude, he doesn't appreciate the fact that this woman is knocking on his door, not because she needs to knock on the door. It's because she's trying to become a part of his life and make sure that he stays part of the community. He doesn't really get that right away, and I'm not sure if he ever gets that until his dying day. But that's clearly what's happening. And then another example of that, again, for those who didn't read the book, another spoiler component here about how, even though he and Rune have this kind of back and forth between the two of them, but ultimately the idea of community and friendship, for sure, he will, over his dead body, are they going to take this man out of his house? He may be struggling with this mental illness, and maybe he doesn't even know who he is anymore, but that you're going to protect your community, especially in the way that he views the community, that he defines himself as part of the community. You don't just drive onto our, you know, there's no vehicular traffic. That's because that's part of what defines their community. You know, I thought
there were a lot of different examples of that, which I thought that was very powerful.
Yeah.
I thought one theme that struck me most is his struggle against the bureaucracy. And to see this leading, breathing person who has very strong emotions coming against the cold machine. And I thought that seemed to go all through the book.
Yes, certainly by the end, when it comes to the white coats, the men in the white shirts, who are coming to take Rune away, and how he has this almost distrust for that apparatus, because of his own experiences and his inner convictions of, you know, just doing what's right and feeling like it doesn't matter what the bureaucracy says. Here's a man, here's a human story, I hear that. Yeah.
In a way, I think the book is almost promotes libertarian ideas. It shows how the community can very well organize itself, and people can chip for each other and support each other without the need for bureaucracy.
So it's interesting that you say that in terms of the question of libertarianism. The counterbalance to that is when Ove was in charge of the community council, not the white shirts, and even when he wasn't, he was very rigid about the rules. Mm-hmm. Rules are rules.
Yep.
So, you know, the fact that somebody wanted to break the rules because they wanted to get their trailer in and move in their stuff, that doesn't matter, because if society says that's the rule, so that's not so much in line with that. Yeah, Athena, what were you?
So I was going to say two things. One, like the sense of justice, and just how much, like, justice. You touched on this already, but how he had a very strong sense of right and wrong. Even as a child, he learned this from his father, that you don't steal, you don't take advantage of other people, and like part of his rigidity is because of his strong belief in justice. But also, I thought that the theme of suffering is very prevalent.
The theme, I'm sorry, I missed
suffering.
That.
We can't hear
it. Suffering. Suffering.
Just 1 second. I'm going to catch it. Suffering. Yes.
It sounds like you.
Sorry, 1 second. Just 1 second.
And like from the time he was a child, he encountered like such. I mean, it was a funny book, but like he had terrible, terrible life experiences. He lost his father. He lost his home. He lost his wife. He lost his baby. Like there were just like so many things that he had dealt with, and he had suffered so terribly that I just kept getting like with the view.
It's interesting. That's interesting. So to reframe. So. You know, the story of Eov is the story of a man who suffers unbearably and struggles with that suffering. What's interesting is you're pointing out that he had terrible suffering. And it's funny because when I read the book, and now that you point that out, I hadn't looked at it from that perspective because in his mind, he actually never viewed himself as the victim of suffering. Right? He never defined his experience, which is interesting. You know, you have people who are, unfortunately, they are the victims of a lot of difficult times, and they view themselves rightfully so. He could have been a very kind of, he could have been looking to end his life because he felt like, ugh, woe is me. He never saw himself that way, which is so, but that's kind of a Musar Haskel, the other way to look at it, is to say, here is a man who lost everything all the time.
But don't you think that's somewhat of why his friendship was ruined? Like, because they had the child and they didn't have the child, that was why they were a little bit removed from one another. I mean, he got mad at them over silly things, but probably underlying was also the fact that they had that child that they didn't have. So somewhat was...
Right, so then maybe there was some resentment there. Yeah, I hear that. I hear that. But I wouldn't say that that really would define him as somebody who was suffering, right? He had resentment. He had a lot of anger issues, for sure.
Right.
A lot of anger issues and the frustration in terms of the suffering of the, you know, of the describes almost the wrath of, you know, he wishes what could he have done to that Spanish bus driver or what could he have done to prevent this or that. And yet, you know, as much as he was frustrated at the authorities, as you alluded to before, they wouldn't build the ramp for Sonia's school. So you know what? He built his own ramp. You don't just sit at home and kind of like cry about it. So yeah, I think that suffering is a part of this book, but I kind of look at it as from a position of strength. This is the man who overcame all of the suffering. And it wasn't that he was looking to end his life because he was tired. He was looking to end his life because it lacked the meaning that he was looking for.
From that point?
Yeah.
I think that's why he was trying to end his life. He didn't realize that he mattered.
Exactly.
Like, he mattered to the whole... I mean, it was a bilateral kind of relationship. The whole community was helping him, and he was helping this entire community, everybody who showed up who he didn't know was really part of his life at the end of his life. So it's like, you know, he who saves whatever. It's a mutual relationship in a community, and he did matter, and he helped so many people.
Right, so that's, you know, a very key thing in a world of Yiddishkeit that we look at, especially especially in the context of a social media society today, which, being that I don't have Facebook or a smartphone, so I'm not so much a part of that, but from what I hear and see on the outside, there is a great challenge. Who was I talking to recently who was describing to me how their social media experience very much diminished people's sense of meaning? And so the idea in a Torah perspective that every person has significant meaning and every life has meaning, that is meant to counterbalance. Because that's ultimately, you know, what is a person looking for? A person is looking to matter. And so the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that God gave every single human being, and especially B'nai B'chori Yisrael, every Jewish person, the opportunity to matter, that's perhaps our greatest gift. It's interesting that when you look at the book of Koheles, it's really just a bunch of nothingness. That's what it is. You know, the whole thing is Hevel Havolim. Why bother? You know why bother? Because if your goal in life is to be, you know, to set yourself on the walk of fame, so then you're going to be pursuing something that is an illusory dream. But Sof Davar HaKol Nishma, what should you do? Be nice to the person next to you. You know, matter to somebody in your life, and they'll matter to you. That's really what the story of Koheles seems to be getting at, which is that if you look at, what's that?
In the book.
And the book. If you look at it on the grand scale, you're right. Everybody ends up in the same Se'if Adama, in the same earth where we all came from. And, you know, as great as many people are, they're forgotten very quickly. And yet, we are given the charge by the Ribbono Shel Olam with that eternal spark of our neshama to matter to somebody and the gift of mattering. Yeah, what were we going to say before?
Oh, you said it.
Oh, okay.
About his challenge, like, the thing that really struck me was the ramp that he built for his wife.
Yeah.
He could have just given up.
Right.
And he had this inner strength to go build that ramp.
Right.
And then it gave her such pleasure, and then she was able to teach him with the children, and, you know, it was that part really struck me. It was amazing for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I saw the power of women. I mean, he said something. Life began when he met his wife. Before that, he was nothing. And then his whole life, you know, was with her. And so when she died and he saw, you know, he looked for things to fix around the house. There was nothing to fix. He went around the neighborhood, make his rounds. He didn't have to, but, you know, he was looking for something. And so he had nothing to do when his wife was gone. He had no other family. And so he wanted to end his life. And then Privana, the Iranian woman, came into his life. And she was a powerful force and found things for him to do and found meaning in his life again. So it's the power of women. Before that, he, as good as he was, he needed a strong woman behind him.
So it could be that it's specifically women, or it could be that a woman, especially in a marriage in this case, is an example of community. Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, in a few places in the essay Community, and then in other places, he describes how a marriage is the first, it's the nuclear community. And that's the space in which people find that they matter. They matter vis-a-vis another person. So it could be, in another sense, a community, but in this case, it's the nuclear community, right? First it was his wife, to whom, you know, he was so devoted, how it describes how he would drive her everywhere and take care of every little thing. So it could be the power of women. It could be that that's an example of community, and it comes back to the same thing of purpose. So yesterday we had a get together in Lincolnwood, right? We spoke about this Mishnah in Ksubas, where the Mishnah in Ksubas talks about obligations that generally Ksubas is about obligations within marriages, obligations that husbands have to wives and wives have to husbands. So one discussion in Mishnah in Ksubas is about how a woman has to take care of certain things in the home. So she has to take care of whatever was the laundry and the food and nursing the children. So the Mishnah discusses, well, what happens if a woman has many servants? She doesn't need to do anything. So the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, that's a terrible thing. It's batala. It's idleness. You don't have any reason to get up in the morning. So one opinion the Mishnah says, batala mevi alidei shi'amum. Idleness leads to, in modern Hebrew, misha'amim means boredom, but Rashi translates it as shigaon. A person who wakes up in the morning and doesn't have someone to call or something to do or someone to love, they go out of their mind. We all need somebody, you know, for whom we matter. That's a very important thing. And that mattering, that's really ultimately what the journey, you know, on a certainly on a Bein Adam L'Chaveiro level is about, is how do we matter to somebody? And so kind of one of the things that emerges from this in terms of the idea of chesed, which is, of course, a big theme in the book, you know, it's even a question, who's doing chesed for whom? You know, he's doing chesed for somebody else by fixing their such and such, but really they're doing a chesed for him. The idea of looking for opportunities to do chesed. You know, the idea that Avraham didn't sit in his tent and wait for somebody to ring the doorbell and say, you know, somebody's going to come visit me. The fact that he went outside to look, pursuing chesed, like rodef stock of a chesed. The Gemara says that in the Aleph Beis, there's an order to the letters, and there's a spiritual depth. So it's Aleph Beis, which means one thing, and then it's Gimel Dalet. Gimel says from the word gomel. Dalet is from the word dal, somebody who is in need. So the Gemara says, why is it that the leg of the Gimel is facing the back of the Dalet? Why should the front of the Gimel, the leg of the Gimel, be facing the Dalet? So it says, why? Because the person who's Gomel Chesed is pursuing the people who need it. You don't just wait to do Chesed for somebody. You're Gomel. You have your foot outstretched to find, to look after that person. So that's one angle. The other one is an interesting way of thinking about who is the giver and who is the recipient of Chesed. You know, Rav Eliyahu Dessler in the Kuntres HaChesed talks about the idea of giving, and he distinguishes between giving and taking. Sometimes it's hard to know who's giving and who's taking, because the Gemara says in Maseches Kiddushin, you can have a person who serves their parent fine delicacies, makes a delicious barbecue dinner, and serves it to their parents, and the Gemara says that person is useless from a spiritual standpoint. It's Gehenna. They have absolutely nothing. And yet, the Gemara says in Kiddushin, you have someone who, they take their parent, and they put the parent at a mill. They make the parent grind at the mill, and that gives that person Olam Haba. It's a tremendous merit. So Rashi, on that Gemara in Kiddushin, says, I don't understand. You have an elderly parent, 87 years old, you ask them to grind in the wheat mill? So Rashi says, you tell me. You want to go first, or should we finish the Rashi?
The reason is because there's an actual example I have.
Yes.
I know an elderly woman at this cleaners, you know, by us, and she was saying, you know, I'm 85 years old, and my son insists I keep working here, and I'm like, what kind of selfish guy makes an 85-year-old mother work? So now you're telling me it's okay to tell them, let them work? I'm sorry, I just can't do that.
Oh, that's a very good segue to the answer. You ready? So Rashi says, I'm going to answer your question. He says, I lived 1,000 years ago, but I know you're going to ask that. So Rashi, right there on the spot, Gemara, Rashi dies in 1105, but he's on to you. He says the following. He says, the first case, you can make somebody a barbecue dinner, but you can serve it to them with a sour face. And you can throw it down on the plate. You know how much that's worth? Rashi says, gurnish mit gurnish, saying Yiddish. It's worth nothing. Yeah, the mitzvah of kibbutz, that's where the sugya, the topic of kibbutz avim, is in the Gemara and Kiddushin. Yeah, it's kibbutz avim. The strict din is you have to feed your parents. You can feed your parents here. That's not kibbutz avim. That's what the Gemara says. That's not kibbutz avim. You feed them with such a foul attitude. Nobody likes that. How do you think they feel after that? Feel terrible, miserable. But the Gemara says, what is this case? The Gemara is the case where you have an elderly person and they're sitting at home and they feel like, you know, that's right. They feel like they don't have so much to contribute. So you know what they do? We put them to work. This year, some of you know we lost both of my grandmothers. So my grandmother from Cleveland, Aleha Shalom, we used to go there And I used to call in advance, and I used to tell her, you know, we used to go visit her at least once a year, and I would tell, you know, we're very much looking forward to coming, and I have to tell you, I'm expecting apple pie and pea soup. And pea soup. Now, it's a little bit rude for a punk to call up an 85-year-old lady and start ordering apple pie and pea soup. But do you know how much she loved to make pea soup? Because she knew that we would eat the pea soup and that she would put a few bags in the freezer and we would take it back. She would love that. She loved me. She was so happy when we would come in. And even though the truth is, don't tell anybody a secret, she could really hardly get up from the table to make the apple pie, and the helper that she had in the kitchen was doing most, apple pie was, you know, I don't know what percentage she was doing and what the helper lady was doing, but in her mind, yes, in her mind, she made us apple pie. And when she came to the table Friday night to serve dessert after the Shabbos meal, she felt so good that she could still make apple pie. And that is what Rashi says is the pshat. So you think, it looks like you're making the person work, you're doing them the biggest chesed.
Right.
You're using that wisdom to find a way to make that person feel good, to make that person feel like they have meaning. My grandmother used to, who passed away this past week in Yerushalayim, so she used to make these little hard European crackers called onion cookies. Whether they were delicious or not is a matter of debate. But one thing is for sure, everybody was always hocking her until she just couldn't do it anymore. She always had to make it. Anybody who would go to Israel would always go and bring them back. Whether they were burnt, whether they were not burnt, it didn't matter. Because she always felt appreciated that she had onion cookies and you have a little bit of liver and your Shabbos lunch is set. If you have liver and onion cookies, that was her way of giving to her children and her grandchildren. And so you actually give that opportunity to the person. So you're not a macabo, you're not a notel, you're not taking, you're giving. And so when you look through the book, who's giving and who's taking? Not so clear who's really giving and who's really taking. What may look on the surface like, how could you make an old person work? The truth is, you're really giving that person an opportunity to feel like they have a reason to get up in the morning. And sometimes that person can't even articulate it. Sometimes they don't quite see it that way. Sometimes, and you see it with Ov for sure, that maybe he starts to figure out that they're doing a chesed for him, but he doesn't really want to live like that. He doesn't want to think that he's receiving a chesed, so he views it that he's doing a chesed for them. And that's a real community. A community is when people do chesed for each other. So I thought, when I was thinking about this, again, to me, this book had nothing to do with somebody who wanted to take their life at all. Really, the book was about love. About avas reyim, about loving other people. And specifically, a love that a man can have for his wife. I thought the whole book was about love. I didn't know it was anything about suicide. Until that person said it, it didn't even dawn on me for a second. I think that the book has tremendous mussar. If Bali Mussar got a hold of this book, they might cut out a few of the words, but they would probably say there's a whole lot to learn from this book, both on the side of what not to do, and on the side of learn of what to do. You know, on the side of what not to do, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Deos that getting angry is one of the worst midos in the world. And it's funny when they describe how one of the girls makes a picture of him and it's turning colors. So they say it's because he does funny things. It's probably because he was also all the time turning colors because he was always enraged about something. So that's probably not a great way to lead your life. Certainly not if you have a heart condition, is to always be running around with a grudge. This idea of holding a grudge, bichlal, not just the anger component, but losikon velositor, you know, at a certain point, he thinks he can remember exactly why he's angry at Rune, but nobody else can figure that out. Because he's holding on to the grudge so long. It's like the people in the shul who are so angry at each other, but they don't even remember why they were angry at each other in the first place. What happened at that kiddush that, you know? So the pasuk says, "Lo sika v'lo sita." You gotta let it go. But there are so many things about this person, about this character, that are overwhelming the negative attributes. I thought that the idea of Yashrus, I think if Adina's still in the house, she might have been pushed out the door. I thought that theme of doing what is right and being principled is the theme that keeps coming up throughout the book, from the beginning to the end, whether it's not telling on the sleazy railway worker who deserved it, but the principle is you don't say a lashon hara about that guy. You don't say it. And what's principally right about, you know, whether somebody should get kicked out of their house or not. You know, kid needs a house, he needs a house. He needs a bed to sleep in. And, you know, all the time, him coming back to the idea of what is right. You know, there is a very long-standing debate in Jewish tradition about an ethic independent of halacha. But whether or not, you know, you get into that from a philosophical standpoint, the idea that the pasuk says, the Ribbono Shel'olam, God made us also as the Adam Yashar, v'hem bikshu cheshbonos rabim, God made people straight. And then they sought all kinds of cheshbonos. But ultimately, Rav Kook, in the Oros HaTshuva, he talks about something called tshuva tivis, natural tshuva, meaning getting down to what deep down we know is just the right thing to do. Before any piety, before any Musar Sfarim, deep down, most people, normal people, they have a matzpun, they have a conscience that we know what's right and what's not. And so here's a man who for the entire time he was alive, all he lived by was what is right, and that's it. Doesn't matter what the men in the white shirts think, it doesn't matter what the neighbors think, it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. If he knew deep down that it was right, that's the conviction that he's gonna look for. Usually, the Rambam points out, and Bali Musa points this out, usually, kaas, anger, is associated with hubris, with gaiva. Usually, I expect something, and if I don't get what I want, I feel frustrated, I feel exasperated, I'm angry. But what I thought was interesting is that I don't think that in this case, Ov has even an arrogant bone in his body. I think his anger came from a sense of almost being indignant at wrongs that he saw in society. You know, that some dog is going to come on his yard, that's just wrong, or driving on the pavement that you shouldn't do. He's angry about those things, but it doesn't come from a sense of self-righteousness. You know, al tachzik tov la'atzmecha, the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, don't hold yourself up to be such a who knows what because you did so many great things. Pilakach nutzarta, that's what you're supposed to do. That's mamish how he viewed himself. He didn't view himself as some kind of hero because he helped this one, or he came up with this, you know, this Einfall to save Rune from being taken away from Anita. He says, you do what you're supposed to do. And that is the ultimate in humility. He didn't think anything of himself. It's just that's, you know, you do the right thing because that's the thing that's supposed to be done. You know, it's a very challenging concept when our generation is the I generation, right? The iTunes and the iPod, everything is about my accomplishment. In the old days, people of a prior generation, maybe some people today still, but you know, this ideal, there's a reason that he's kind of the caricature of the old school curmudgeon. And today, you know, it's not like that. You have all kinds of different ways of looking at things. But that's what it was like. People lived a life of service, and they didn't go around patting themselves on the back. You know, this past week when I went to be Menachem Aval, so my father brought home a bunch of things from my grandmother's apartment. My grandfather's been gone since before my bar mitzvah, but she kept a lot of things. Some of them, he had an amazing life, which is not for tonight, but he had an amazing life, and a lot of the things had been given to an archive for historical purposes, and some of the things she had kept. And My father brought back this, like, treasure trove of things, whether they were coins from Palestine, where my grandfather went in the early 1930s as a teenager with undershirt and shorts and a shovel to build the land, to medals that he had gotten and other interesting medals that we didn't know that he had. He had actually several German medals that he must have picked off of somebody. I don't know if that person was living or dead by the time he got a hold of him, but he was in the infantry. He did have, I showed you that picture, he had kept two boxes of dinner rations from his time in France in 1944, so I haven't, we're going to decide who's going to open that and see what, that's been sold with chametz many times, you can imagine, since then. But I remember him as a kid, he never talked about, my father also told me, he never talked about the war, he never talked about what he did. I only found out afterwards, people only found out, my grandmother mentioned once that in 1948, there were some guys who showed up to the house at night and knocked on the door and asked if Max Brand was there, and he went out and he was gone for a couple hours, and he would come back in the middle of the night, and he told her that you can't ask where I'm going because I can't talk to you about it. And for many years later, until the 60s, she told me that she didn't know that at night there was a guy who would put him in the back of a car, cover him with a blanket so he shouldn't see where he's going. He would end up in some discreet location in the Brooklyn docks where he was running guns to Israel. And he didn't tell her because he was afraid if he ever got arrested that she would get into hot water, so she never knew. But he never talked, because at that time, you just do what's right because that's what's right. Al tachzik tov la'atzmecha. You don't need an award. It happens to be that he had a box full of medals from the United States Army, but you put them in the drawer. You don't go around showing it off to people. And it's such an amazing Musar Haskel of just doing what's right because that was right. Another interesting takeaway has to do with kind of his obsessiveness with order, which is interesting. He's very interested in order. And Rav Shlomo Volbe has an essay in the Alei Shur about the idea of being mesudar, and that being mesudar, being organized, is a very important part of keeping your life together and your approach as an Oved Hashem, making sure that everything has its place. And it's not shocking to us that the halacha is very insistent on order. There's a time and a place for everything. And the more you climb the ladder of sanctity, the more sensitive we are about order. You know, you have to daven shacharis at a certain time, you have to daven mincha at a certain time, you have to daven ma'ariv at a certain time. There's an order. You can't just daven mincha whenever you want. There's an order. But then when you go to the Beis HaMikdash, the order is even more stringent. So much so that you have to stand in a certain place, and your knife has to be in a certain place, and your mindset has to be in a certain place. If you're thinking about something else, that you're going to be out of order, you're thinking about eating the carbon the day after you're allowed to eat it, you have disqualified the whole carbon from the start. It's called pigul. Because you're out of order. Everything has to be misudar. And for some of us, part of the challenge of a modern world is that because we have so much technology and so much access and so much busyness, it's difficult to stay misudar. Right? It's difficult to make time for everything and not always be rushing and always be late and always pile too many things on your plate at the same time. This was a man, everything was misudar. He had enough time to go to the store. He had enough time to go home. He had no problem getting, he never ran late. He was never rushed. Never, don't rush. I learned this from Rabbi Pelkovitz, the Chorin of Rafa. When I used to push him in the wheelchair, we used to have a slogan, don't rush. When we would walk, you know, he would take like an eighth of a step at a time, 90 plus years old, but he would still walk. We would say, you know, everybody else was 7 miles ahead of us. We would say, don't rush. You know, but he was always very misudar. He would leave on time. He would arrive on time. There's something about being disciplined as an ideal in our Avodas Hashem. Maybe two more thoughts and then we'll take any last minute comments. It's interesting that even Ov is able to admit when he's wrong, which is not an easy thing to do for somebody who's very principled and who works hard his whole life. It is difficult to admit that one is wrong, particularly when one has been wrong for a very long time. This is in the context of Amel, but it's true in general, that part of what to me is interesting about this book is you see the development of Ove and how he's growing. And at the beginning of the book, he's very rigid the whole book, don't worry, he doesn't give that up. But at the beginning of the book, he has a certain view of things, and then it develops, it changes, it morphs, it grows over time. You know, and this idea of admitting that you're wrong, taking a second look at something, you notice how like he begrudgingly starts to do that. You know, all of a sudden, maybe the internet, I like how they, the capital, the internet, maybe it's not as evil as he thought it was at the beginning. You know, or maybe the kids aren't as annoying as he first thought that they were. It's hard to admit you're wrong. It's hard to change your perspective. Change is difficult. But that's one of the beautiful things about this book, is that you see even somebody who is so intense and so fixed in his ways, even that person can find ways to grow. And then I'll just circle back to where I started, which was to me, the big theme of this book is about love. And he has one line about Sonia and about how we can think about love, about Ahava. Loving someone is like moving into a house, Sonia used to say. At first, you fall in love with all the new things, amazed every morning that all this belongs to you, as if fearing that someone would suddenly come rushing in through the door to explain that a terrible mistake had been made. You weren't actually supposed to live in a wonderful place like this. Then, over the years, the walls become weathered, the wood splinters here and there, and you start to love that house, not so much because of all its perfection, but rather for its imperfections. You get to know all the nooks and crannies, how to avoid getting the key caught in the lock when it's cold outside, which of the floorboards flex slightly when one steps on them, or exactly how to open the wardrobe doors without them creaking. These are the little secrets that make it your home. That's what he remembers that Sonia used to say. And isn't that what real love is about? About making space for someone else and appreciating them for who they are, even though they are imperfect. Where does this come from? It comes from the source of all love, endless love, the makor of everything, the Ribbono Shel Olam. Ahavti Eschem. The Ribbono Shel Olam says he loves us. So why should he love us? We have so many flaws, we have so many shortcomings, we have so many imperfections. Ahavti Eschem. Haben Yakir Li Ephraim. So perhaps it's not just that he loves us because he thinks that one day we're going to become perfect. He loves us because of our imperfections. Because he knows that we're trying, that we want to become better, that we do have some redeeming qualities. He has this way of appreciating us. You know, he looks at those with a different eye. Some of it might be selective memory, like the Gemara says in Brachos. Gemara says in Brachos, the Pasuk says that the Jewish people looked at Hashem Yisbarach and said, well, maybe you will forget us. Vatomer Tzion Azavani Hashem VaHashem Shchichani. Maybe you'll forget us. And the Navi says, what are you talking about? HaSishkach Isha Olam Mirachim Ben Bitna? Gam Eile Tishkachana V'Onochi Lo Ishkachich. Some things I forget, but some things I don't forget. So the Gemara Bracha says, you know what that means? It means that the Ribbono Shel Olam forgets the Maisa HaEgel, that catastrophic event. He still forgets that. But the love for us, he doesn't forget. That he always remembers. That's selective memory. So my grandmother, Olah Shalom, she only had one good ear, so she used to have selective hearing. You know, what she wanted to hear, she heard from the good ear. What she didn't want to hear, she said, I can't, it's the other. She's very selective about that. So selective memory. So that's the way the Ribbono Shel Olam looks at us, that there is an element of selective memory. So when you love somebody, you're willing to forgive certain small things. And then you come to appreciate those imperfections. You understand where that person is coming from. You understand the whole entirety of them. You get to appreciate them. And the Ribbono Shel Olam, he believes in us and he loves us and he gives that concept of love into the world. And so to me, and I'll just open it up for any closing thoughts of anybody else. This is a book about love. And that's what the Ribono Shel Olam gives us. And so obviously we have to pay it forward in concentric circles of the V'ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha, of thinking about how can we create a loving community to pursue chesed, right? Rodev stock of a chesed, not just to sit back and wait for it, but in a community, you have to go out there. You have to seek out opportunities for chesed. Those are expressions of Ava, right? Avraham is called Zera Avraham Ohavi. Avraham is the paragon of love. What else is he called? The Ish Chesed. That all comes from the same place. It's really a book of love and what we can learn to love and to give to other people. Any final thoughts? Our hostess, are you back there? Do you want to add anything, Adina? Anything we didn't get to? Yes.
You know, I enjoyed your perspective, but I'm just curious. Why did you want to pick up this book in the first place?
Great question. I don't know. All I know is that my mother-in-law had it, and usually I read the perurim, the crumbs of what my mother-in-law is reading. So she happened to have this book, and I picked it up, and I said, this is one of the best books I've ever read. No question about it. So that's why I felt like I had to share it, you know. But I don't know exactly how she got to it. I don't know. But that's where I got it. I got it from my mother-in-law. Yes?
I would just like to thank you for your review, because I read the book a long time ago.
Okay.
And when I read it, and I've told all my friends and all of my children, I thought I was reading about my husband. It described my husband to a T in his younger days. He was a stickler for rules. He would run a mile to help somebody who was in need. If he believed in something, he had the strongest backbone, and still does, of anybody I know.
All right, so that's a beautiful lesson. Did your kids read it?
Absolutely.
And did they agree with you?
My friends read it too. They don't know. They only know my husband since he got old.
Okay. All right, we want to thank Adina and David for hosting tonight. Thank you all for coming. I guess we have to decide. One of the things we asked the question at the Women's Council meeting was, do we want this to continue? Do we want to do this?